Hi, I'm Joanna Chaundy, and you're listening to Series 3 of the Baggy Jeans podcast, where I chat to the female music artists who have made R&B so unforgettable. We take a nostalgic look back at the music, the fashion, the videos, and the industry. So whether you're a newbie to this genre or just want to come and reminisce, tune in to Baggy Jeans, where I unpick the seams of R&B. My guest this week was the former lead singer of the UK-based group The Brand New Heavies. They achieved huge success with hits such as Midnight at the Oasis and Dream on Dreamer. She's worked with so many greats, including Malcolm McLaren, Bootsy Collins, Daniel Lanois, Mark Ronson, Jay Dilla and Guru of Gangstar, to name a few. She left The Brand New Heavies in 1995 after an acrimonious split, and has ended up in Japan, primarily working on her love of dance music. She has kept quiet for nearly two decades about why she left the group, but now exclusively with Baggy Jeans, wants to put the record straight. She is, of course, Endia Davenport.
So how long have you been living in Japan?
Believe it or not, it will be 9 years next month.
Wow.
I have been off a little bit away. I mean, I travel back and forth to help with my family, my mom and everything. Mm-hmm. But my father passed away a few years ago. So now it's just my mom and I. So I'm trying to make sure to go back home often. But mm-hmm. but yeah, just being here, you know, it's been wonderful, though. I really enjoy it.
How is life in Japan compared to the States?
It's like night and day, especially at a time, I guess, when the States, when they're going through so many transitions and it's so confusing and there's people fighting and there's, the whole mess of also the politics that's happened since I've left. Because I left, I think, when Obama was president.
Okay, so a while ago.
It was a while ago. So, the whole political backdrop has become so crazy, like to the point I don't even know it like I did before. It's like a completely different country. And a lot of things have changed. And here, it's like the total opposite, where there's people are polite, there's a sense of peace,
yeah,
sense of respect. I think especially for women, it's important to be able to feel like if you have to go out to the store or something in the middle of the night or whatever, or coming walking home, you feel safe. It's
yeah.
The first place I haven't experienced that in many, many, many years.
We got to know Endia Davenport, obviously, from the Brand New Heavies when you blew up with them around, yeah. I think it was like that, what, 1994 maybe, with the main blow up singles?
The main blow up, yeah, would definitely have been 94.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. I'm interested to know, because you'd done a hell of a lot of stuff before you even got into the Brand New Heavies.
Absolutely.
So can you just take us on a little bit of a journey on what you were doing before you came to London to join that group?
Sure. Well, my personal situation was one that I had put in hours and hours of preparation and working towards my craft without even realizing what I was going to end up doing. So aside from singing and performing, I was also involved in theater and stage management, curating shows, small opportunities in film, a dance scholarship, all before graduating college with a public relations degree. So,
oh, wow, that's impressive.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's pretty funny, but after graduation, I mean, I could not wait to get out in the world and just explore and kind of see what I hadn't experienced before. As well, I'd never traveled anywhere much without my parents, so I decided to go to Los Angeles. I saved up a few hundred dollars and left town thinking I would only be there for like 2 weeks. But after meeting a director while acting in this theatrical production back at home, he suggested, you should go to LA. So when I got there, he just happened to be directing this one-woman show at this small theater in Hollywood and needed a stage manager. So I totally jumped at the opportunity. So after the show closed, I didn't have a place to stay. And the host where I was living, I couldn't stay there any longer. So the director of the theater said I could stay in the attic there until the next show opened. It was totally as ghetto as you can imagine. It was so broken down, you know, so it was definitely nothing fancy. But, you know, it was such a great experience. I had never experienced that before. You know, I had a very, I would say, a nice middle class, comfortable existence with my family or back at home. But it did the job. It was perfect. It was kind of exciting, like camping out, you know. So while spending time there, I met the friend of the actress where I was doing the stage managing the play, who happened to be a friend of and a singer for Prince.
Oh, so wow. Nice.
Imagine that. And she had heard that I had a great voice and asked me why I wasn't pursuing my singing. So she invited me to do this backing live gig. And that opportunity led to a demo recording session and another, then another. And then I went on to singing commercial jingles and major background and featured recording sessions with some of the most influential people and artists at that time. You know, some of the people were like, I went on my first time outside of the United States. I went on this world tour with Al Jarreau.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, that was my first live touring situation. Then I did some recordings and featured things with Malcolm McLaren, Bootsy Collins. And I met Malcolm, you know, through some associates of mine that had heard about, I got recommended, that was calling. It's kind of a long story, but I won't go into that detail. But the combination and the production team of Bootsy Collins, Dave Stewart from Eurythmics.
That's right, yeah.
From Malcolm's record. And that we became great friends with all of those people. But there were so many others. I mean, my God, they were hip-hop artists. There were, I mean.
Well, didn't you have some kind of connect with Fab Five Freddy, who introduced you?
Absolutely. I'll get to that. So this was like the late 80s, you know, when there was this booming global art and club subculture happening in warehouses and downtown art spaces, right? So especially going on and around LA. So daytime jobs for me were recording sessions. And at night, I was hired and a part of this popular dance troupe for this extremely ambitious dance club featuring local art students and their working. So it was almost like I was like a dancing art installation. So, but anyway, it got the attention of music video people, directors, casting agents, and it led to several different acting gigs, like the fashion music and the arty cool types and the in-the-know people always migrated there. So I even met these pop icons like Keith Haring and Jean-Michel Basquiat, and an integral person that led me steps toward my first record deal, Fab Five Freddy. Freddie was close friends with the DJ that was starting this record label in LA called Delicious Vinyl. So I started putting a few musicians sometimes together at some of the nightclubs and spots, you know, within these migrations of subcultures of clubs that were going on around town as well. And I casually did these live shows to show what I could do. And I was approached to sign the label Delicious Vinyl. So that's how I really came to getting to that first record label opportunity. So while I was working on that first release at Delicious, they were working on signing this band from the UK called the Brand New Heavies. The Heavies at the time were signed to a London-based label, Acid Jazz Records.
Just Giles Peterson's label.
And then there was Talking Loud. So obviously, if people don't know the history of Talking Loud and Acid Jazz, they as well had the history of being DJs and starting record labels. And, you know, at that time as well, people were really young. There was nobody even barely over 25 starting these labels independently and then getting I guess, distributed by major labels, because they had their ear to the ground. So it was quite easy. It was just like, and so fun. And, but there were a lot of pluses and there were a lot of minuses that comes along with that, because we go into a situation where if there's no one around to be the voice of reason or have great mentors that are wise enough to kind of guide you, things sort of can go off the rails a bit in so many different areas of the business, of artistry, of whatever the possibilities are, that there's not like someone that could just reel you in a bit, you know?
So you felt like you didn't have that with Delicious Vinyl?
Well, I didn't with Acid Jazz either.
Acid Jazz, right. Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, a year prior to you being with the Brand New Heavies, Dave Stewart asked you to come over to London to sign you, didn't he?
He sure did. It was, you know.
And was that as a solo artist? He wanted you on your own?
Well, this is interesting. I mean, I don't know if I should say this, and no disrespect to them, but, you know, since we're, you know, things are all on the table now. When I met Dave through Malcolm, actually, and working with them, and we all just, I started spending a lot of time around his organization. I initially as well, I had a few options, because at the time he was married to Siobhan, formerly of Bananarama.
Oh, yes, that's
and
right.
And Shakespeare's sister.
Shakespeare's sister, yeah.
That's right. And so I had either two options. I could either go on and just do my solo record, or Siobhan was really interested in me to being one other half of Shakespeare's sister. No disrespect,
no
Marcy. Marcy, I'm friendly with both of them, but she may know, but she may not know.
That's a great fact to know. My God.
Yeah, but I think it ended up happening for them so beautifully and so much more perfectly. And at the time, I was a little bit worried about, okay, this is my debut coming out. I don't want it to look so commercial. Because at the time, there were two girls that were really, and they were in the UK, and it just seemed so bubblegum and pop to me. And I just didn't want us to come off that way. Obviously, that was not the plan. And as well, at the time, I wasn't quite ready to leave for London yet at that point. Although I was surrounded by so many British people, it's almost like I could not get away from British people. You were calling me. You wouldn't let me go. So, you know, I think there's a reason for that, obviously, as fate would have it. And Dave did offer me that deal. And
What was he like to work with?
I mean, so lovely, so cool, just so laid back, but so brilliant. You know, I love working with people that also have a great sense of taste. He had just really great taste. And all the people around that crew, Siobhan and Sophie Mueller, the video director, filmmaker, they just had such great taste. And I did always, that was my first inkling of understanding how brilliant the British were at concepts and building ideas around visual products and of music and art. You know, you guys are the best that do that. I hands down, I just want to give you an applaud. I mean, applaud.
Thank you.
You for all for that. You're brilliant at the
we'll
concept.
Take that.
It's very true. Very true. That's your specialty. You know, but obviously it wasn't meant to be. And I had collaborated with so many people before I even met the Heavies. I brought so much to the table with just by chance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when the combination happened, you know, I think I was more than prepared.
Were you skeptical about joining a group, or did you always have it in your head you wanted to be a solo artist?
No, I had no at all idea about joining a group. That's the craziest thing. And I had done all these things and building this name in Los Angeles. I mean, to the point that my first album was in the industry and with people, it was really highly anticipated as well. Another fun fact, it was noted on the, as being one of the persons or one of the artists to look out for in the 90s. And I'm on the cover with people like Mariah Carey and others like that. And so it was highly anticipated, this solo career. It just by chance, because I enjoyed collaboration so much, when the Brand New Heavies were signed to Delicious or licensed, because Acid Jazz licensed the Brand New Heavies to Delicious Vinyl for the US representation. And so after they got licensed to Delicious, they didn't have a vocalist. However, there had been vocals done with the record, you know, vocals done before another vocalist before I got there. And I think also there were male vocals on a couple of the songs that became very popular. However, you know, it was approached to me about, hey, this band, what do you think about this band? You know, I'm like, I really like the music, because also the record that I was attempting to do on my solo record, it all featured live instrumentation. And I thought, wow, for other young people that are wanting to do live music, because at that time it was very, very synth heavy, you know, the diggy diggy dig, that whole, you know, and I just did not want to have that appeal. I did not want to present that, which is another reason why Malcolm introduced me to Bootsy Collins, thinking that maybe Bootsy would be one of the persons to, you know, and I knew he knew that funk. I knew, you know, they knew that sound that I was trying to get. So the Brand New Heavies, sight unseen, I heard the music and I was like, oh, I like it. So I decided to do the recording. So I got on a plane and went over, did about four, I think it's like four recordings. I re-recorded maybe three songs and did maybe a new song or something like that. Was paid a very, very minimal fee for everything. Because I think too, people just didn't realize what was about to happen. And again, you're talking a young person and young people that's like, okay, well, at least there's something, you're getting paid. I guess that was kind of like what they were thinking at the time. But anyway, the recordings were done. It wasn't very, very long. And it was the first time actually I met them. I think when I flew over to do the recordings, I had never even seen what they looked like. It was just easy to work with them because it was along the same lines that we were coming from, a same musical or creative ideal about, you know, how to present our music situation. But this was the craziest thing. So I'm like, okay, I'm getting into this. But an executive at Delicious Vinyl made it very clear that their focus would be specifically on the guys and not about me. And you would think that they would want to promote me with the band, considering I was already on the label.
And how does that work? Like, we're not going to focus on the lead vocalist. We're going to focus on the others.
Okay, well, this is the real reason I'm not pictured on the cover of the first Brand New Heavies album after my inclusion. I mean, I did insist, and I got it legally binding, that the title within the credits would be the Brand New Heavies featuring India Davenport.
Yeah.
Right. So I kind of ended up sort of being a secondary thought on several occasions in favor of the guys getting the royal treatment. And how the guys' attitudes were drastically changing towards me in those early days.
Were they welcoming initially when you first got into the group? Yes. Was it quite a hard?
Yeah. Yes. No, they were very welcoming. Very welcoming. We had some fun times and just getting to know each other, you know. And, you know, again, at that time, British artists and people weren't as infiltrated with United States people at that time, with people from the States, and definitely not as much in creative situations. So Americans were so enamored by British accents, British culture. The whole thing was just a novelty. So they were getting the freaking the red carpet rolled out all around them, you know? And I'm sort of like, wow, even though I've been here and I've been doing the work, okay. And, it, you know, I took it in stride. I really did. I took it in stride and I just continued on. But, and also, after things started kind of getting in motion, people started really kind of recognizing, and because the public and the press had a very, very different idea about my presence as a lead singer of the group.
Well, absolutely, and because you brought the look and the coolness to the Brand New Heavies.
I'd already released the record here, right? Because I had a friend at MTV that actually created MTV, Yo MTV Raps, that I, before I connected with the Heavies, I said, do you know this band, the Brand New Heavies? And she was like, oh yeah, I know who they are. They have minimal success, blah, blah, blah. Nowhere near to the level of what we created together or after my inclusion. You know, it was a very, very different situation. And at the same time, it was the first time I think that more of the main public would come to know the name of the band prior to primarily being based just, you know, in the UK or Europe, you know. These are some of the first early signs of trouble when the boys started, after a while, they started noticing and displaying very difficult moments, accepting and sharing the spotlight with the new girl singer, you know, an outsider to their boys club. But there was a lot that I was bringing to the table other than just a girl singer.
Like, well, I mean, you were completing the band and giving it, you know, right, the mainstream focus that they needed.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the fun fashion, you know, I was coordinating our images, a lot of our images, and important for a band. And I had the ability to write and co-produce music as well, curate a lot of our staging for some of our most legendary performances, you know. So I mean as four primary members, and at that time too there were other members, they were not just three other musicians. There was a sax player and there was another percussionist, and the percussionist ended up leaving the band, and the sax player, for some reason, just mysteriously, he was gone. It's like I think they were trimming the fat, trying to improve the whole environment, you know.
It was Andy and Simon's group, right? So it's their baby, and they probably...
Well, it was Yan Kincaid.
Okay, yeah.
It was the three of them, and at that point, they basically started taking the reins as far as a lot of the decisions of what was to happen. And the funny thing, though... The saxophone player, his name was Jim Wellman. I'd love to get in touch with him and just say hello or something. So if anybody knows how to find Jim Wellman. But anyway, he actually wrote one of my favorite Brand New Heavy songs that none of us wrote, which was called Stay This Way. So okay. In a way, he kind of gets to get the last laugh, even though I think they had him to exit the band because it's just such a huge fan favorite. And I really love that tune, you know?
Yeah.
But I think
great tune.
But I think, you know, in a lot of respects, the four, after the combination, the four of us of the core members, after it ended up being, I think we all each played significant roles that made the formula sort of naturally work. But unfortunately, there's a disease mindset sometimes that comes along with bands that have a front singer that they just have trouble with sharing spotlight with. And it's like a diseased mindset of a bit of jealousy.
Egos
that sort of just started brewing. So then London Records in the UK obviously took notice of the upgrade of and wanted to sign us as a unit. At that point, Delicious would eventually be out of the picture, and Acid Jazz was soon to follow. But an entirely new base. And then, you know, things started kind of really falling more appropriately in place. You know, there was new London based management. They were chosen, by the way, though, but I wasn't offered the choice during the majority ruling decision of that management team. And it was kind of chosen without my knowledge after promising that we would all make the decision together. And at this time, I'm trying to commute back and forth from London to Los Angeles. And I mean, it was just getting really taxing on my life. And, you know, it was getting really difficult. However, for the first time, I started feeling really optimistic that we would all have an equal say with respectability and a much more balanced relationship with this, with London Records and with the new management. The problem with that, though, is because I still lived in LA and all of our business was based in London, where the real decisions were being made.
So you were out of the loop for some of it.
For some of it, you know, it was impossible. And as well, even if I did have representation in which all my representation was based in Los Angeles. And this was before the internet and before I could speak to you so easily. It was just British Telecom. And if you can imagine what my phone bills were like.
Oh, I can imagine.
It was British Telecom, and it was the time differences that could never align. So in a way, I just had to kind of be out there a lot of times just on my own.
So how often would you come back to London then?
Well, this was in the earlier days. I'd have to come back maybe, it depended on what was required, you know. Sometimes I'd be in LA, and then we'd have to have some sort of promotion or something in Dunkirk, France. So I have to leave LA, get on a flight, go to London, then go to Dunkirk, then come right back. Okay. Things like that. This was just a constant, you know, it was almost like sometimes at the drop of a hat, these scenarios started happening. You know, it was really a taxing time trying
to. Did they give you an ultimatum that you had to move to London, or was that your choice?
No. That was my choice. Desiring more support while working overseas, I feared that things would kind of continue also being imbalanced without being fairly considered. So I needed to really make a decision. Like, I'm just going to fly. I'm just going to move. So that's how I ended up living in London. Living in London was interesting. It was great. And at those days, it was so fun. Bjork lived down the street. Annie Lennox lived around the corner. And on some occasions, I hang out with Bjork, and I have a regret that she was really wanting me to also be that first album, that debut. She really wanted me to do some vocals with her or be featured on that album. I could kick myself about that one, but I was always busy with the heavies. Or made to, as we come to later find out, made to be busy. But she was a ball of fun. She was a ball of fun. It was interesting, you know, in London at that time. And I think everywhere was such a special, we were so lucky to be around in the 90s. I think it was the last great artistic and creative area globally.
Absolutely.
It really was, especially in London. I couldn't have been in the best in a better place to really expound on after Los Angeles, you know, which that was probably the last great era of Los Angeles. And then to come to London, where fashion was fantastic. I remember St. Martin's College, the College of Fashion, and I remember Alexander McQueen getting the award that they give to one student every year, and him him being so great. I was like, oh my God, this guy is fantastic. And also the offices of Acid Jazz were very, very close to St. Martin's. And so we crisscross a lot of these art students and fashion people all the time right there. Was it near Charing Cross Road and Tottenham Court Road?
Of course, the Astoria would have still been there on Tottenham Court
Road. Oh yeah, the Astoria was there. And I remember always they had what's the newspaper? Is it called The Issue? They always have the homeless.
The Big Issue.
The Big Issue, that's right. These guys will always be on that street.
Yeah,
They're still there.
Yep.
That's incredible. That is incredible. So you know, I literally turned into a bit of a British girl.
Absolutely.
Being absorbed in the culture.
Well, you brought the coolness and the fashion to the Brand New Heavies. I mean, I just always, whenever I think of Midnight at the Oasis, I just remember that red dress, thinking how cool it looked in the video. Yourself in those videos.
Well, this is the craziest thing too, and like I said, you know, we went through so many phases with different labels and different people involved, but most of them were almost all men. So they, at that time as well, you know, especially for Black girls, you know, I was really fortunate because, again, I'm coming from Los Angeles, where hair and makeup is just it's an afterthought. And especially at that time in the early 90s, and I think I heard one of your interviews with Don Robinson from En Vogue, and we had, you know, it was when fashion stylists, makeup artists, you know, there was a team in LA that basically would take us them under our wing. If we already had a bit of fashion, I already had a bit of individuality with my fashion and style out of necessity, not because I had the money to be able to just go out and buy it. But it's like Los Angeles was just such an amazing backdrop of those types of people that picked up on that. And in my case, with the notoriety of the Brand New Heavies, they could kind of rise more so to the occasion with world-class makeup artists. This one particular one, this team that, like I said, Dawn and those guys, and they had all of the hot girls. They had me, it was this guy, Roberto Leon, who was amazing at hair. And it was always difficult as a female, a black woman, to have people that understood your hair, the texture, and to make it really snap into place with your outfit. So, and as well, Troy Jensen, who had was a fantastic makeup artist, and we're still friends to the day. Unfortunately, Roberto is no longer with us. But you know, this was the era of the supermodel, the musician, and connecting. It was a beautiful time. And a lot of times when you'd be, we also were young people again, keep in mind, we were young people traveling around the world, living this jet set life.
Yeah.
And getting together for the first time, hanging out at parties, being invited out to different events. And so it was this connection as well, like not only through your makeup and hair people, but it was just, you know, guys getting together with girls, and it was just such an exciting time.
Such a free time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, you know, yeah. And it was the era of the supermodel as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it was perfect timing. I was into fashion. I connected with so many people on that level. And then as well, I think fashion designers from all over the world, you know, after the supermodel era, during that time, you know, they would always, I guess maybe it just turned into being a bigger thing, having music artists and celebrities sit at the front of your shows. You know, I remember Giorgio Armani inviting us to Milan for one of his shows. And at the same time, Dolce & Gabbana was, I don't know if they were in competition, but it was very, very interesting. During that same time, there were the Dolce & Gabbana people, and then there were the Armani people. And I remember being in the same hotel with Linda Evangelista, and Naomi Campbell would come, and that's a whole nother scenario that was very, very interesting. I don't think I should ever say that publicly.
I can imagine that was an interesting night, India.
It was very, very, very interesting. I will say so, if I say so myself.
When you blew up mainstream over here, now we're talking Midnight at the Oasis, brilliant mm-hmm. single, amazing video. Mm-hmm. Maria Muldaur's cover.
Maria Muldaur.
And Dream on Dreamer, another outfit that I loved you in that video. Dream on Dreamer.
Thing too, the guys were stylish guys. I mean, that whole mod thing that was happening at Acid Jazz and, you know, the Talking Loud situation, they were very stylish guys, but there weren't a lot of women around.
No, really, and the industry, did you find as a Black woman in the industry, even in London, not so much the States, that you had to fight harder to be heard for things?
Oh my God. That was such a new reality, I guess, for me, because again, you know, when I first came to the UK, there were four channels on the telly, four channels. That was an eye opener. You know, there were just, it was literally very archaic at the time, no disrespect, but it was very different to what, coming from Los Angeles, where everything's at your fingertips. And then going to London, where, wow, it was an eye opener. But I took it in stride. I learned to work with it. But at the same time, there hadn't been a lot of women, especially Black women, that, and I'm sure this is in many, many businesses, in corporations all across the board, you know, they had never really experienced someone that had a voice, had a good opinion, and, you know, could be outspoken in a healthy way, not this sort of like, I want to come and take over. That was never really my attitude. And I think sometimes a lot of men at that point, I think everywhere, they were used to like, well, you just stand there, or you know, they were used to like running the show. They were used to just people just, especially Black women, like, oh, well, you know, you're a singer. You can just stand over there and just do the songs. Stop your moaning. They took it as moaning. I can't tell you the hundreds of times I've heard, oh, just stop your moaning. And I'm like, it's not moaning. It is actually having a constructive
opinion
about, you know, about certain decisions. And a lot of those decisions were not in my favor, are not being considered, because also, you know, the band members there, they could go home to their families at night. I'm trying to crisscross across the globe to still keep up my business profession outside of the UK, and as well try to be appeasing to my responsibilities there. In London, it was a lot of sacrifice.
Of course, and you're young as well. It's quite a daunting thing to be on your own in a different country.
Oh, my God. And being the only female out of all of these guys, you know, so many times it was very frustrating. It just became so difficult and frustrating. And you can imagine as well, me coming and changing the dynamic of things, certain attitudes really, really, really were very, very hard. You know, it's some very cruel sort of moments that I had to endure, especially after a certain point with my bandmates. I think it was very, very challenging for them to recognize that here I came from as an outsider. And then their complete profile completely changed, but it was a kind of a denial about it. And I think so many times they took absolutely the wrong approach. Instead of being as welcoming, it was almost like I started becoming a threat.
Right.
And as you can see, if you go back to that Brand New Heavies album, the Brother Sister album in the 1994 release, as you can see on my face, which I had to style myself that day as well, there's just mysteriously never any budget left or whatever when it came to that. And one of the guy's friends, they taunted me the entire day. It was just so miserable that day. So that's why I have-
In what respect? How?
Just, I think, you know, again, it's almost a strange sort of thing that started happening because, and I don't want to say specific names, I won't say specific names, but there's definitely one person that was in the band that had this real issue about me being there. And, you know, he would continuously, with so many of like the music execs or stuff, definitely friends, you know, or people, because I was only meeting at that time their friends, and how they would kind of turn their friends against me, making it extremely lonely. I never had any time outside of working, because I was always working, always traveling. So there was still, I had great social times and some of my off times, but mm-hmm. a lot of those people that we were surrounded by were their friends. So
that must have been quite isolating, I would have thought, many a time.
Absolutely. Lonely.
Did you have anyone to talk to at that time, or friends that you'd made that you could confide in?
Well, there were a couple of girls and people that I did confide in, or that I could, you know, that I met while I was there. There were just a few, because there just wasn't a lot of time. And as well, when you're
forge friendships.
Yeah, to forge friendships. You just don't have that time. You don't even have it. And it started being this circle around me, I think, as well, that even at the time, you know, even guys that may have wanted to get to know me, there was no time really for that. Very little time. And it was sort of a being shielded from a lot of that, too. I was very isolated. It became very lonely and it's not like the same London today as well, where even to hear Black voices in the UK, it's like, where is everybody? Like, you know, and I'm coming from the States, and, you know, there's a sense of community or Black community. And, you know, not that that's the only thing that I was desiring, but when you're familiar with something, having a background of community, you know, you sort of long for that. And yeah. So there was that factor as well that, you know, it was a challenge. It was a real challenge, you know.
And do you think that there was a lot of jealousy because you had, I mean, you again had a lot of experience in the industry before you even met these guys? So it's not like you went in fresh and green and, you know, not knowing what you were doing. So, you know, well, you've done some amazing collaborations. I think before you blew up with the Heavies, had you already done the collaboration with Guru on Jazzmatazz? And nothing to it, but it's hard, sweetheart, and it's rough out here. But I doubt there is anybody else for me. Just me.
This is the funny thing with Guru, because Guru, you know, I met Guru actually when I was in college.
Really? And he's an old friend of mine. When I lived in New York, I knew him from London. I interviewed him quite a lot of times, and such a sweetheart.
He's just, just miss him so much. Yeah. I think of him so often, and, you know, in spirit. I don't know if people believe in this, but I do believe when you have very interesting connections with people, and then they pass on, they continue to live with you, or they continue to give you warnings, or they continue to sort of guide you. They're sort of your invisible angels, supposedly, you know, in some respects. And there's been so many instances. I remember the day he passed, and it was like he was in my home. I could feel his presence. I could feel his kind of warnings about a lot of things that to avoid, to so I wouldn't make the missteps. But I have felt his presence on so many of an occasion. It's it's almost, it's just bizarre, but it gives me a lot of confidence to know that, you know, that we do have these spirit guides.
Mm. So how did that collab happen then? You said you met him in college.
Yeah, well, I did, but I never knew he was into music in college. I had been doing all these different things around the different campuses and everything. But years later, and after that hip hop record, he was like, you know what? I had been trying to get, I wanted to do the collaboration with you on that hip hop record. When it came down to it, I'm like, you're kidding. He's like, nobody would get in touch with you. Nobody would every time we asked, they wouldn't ever get back in touch with you. They wouldn't let us know that what happened. He said, it took forever to try to even get to you at this point. And so
I was nothing's like, changed there, India. It took me a year.
Yeah, but it wasn't for sake of not wanting to be, you know, to speak
with you. You can see.
I know. But you know, but I was like, well, that's so strange. And then several times the PR people, you're speaking now, let's link this back into the jealousy. The PR people would have to sometimes sneak away from the band because so many other members of the press, I remember this one New York Magazine, only wanted to speak with me. And the guys would have this really big, it was always a big issue. Anytime that people wanted me and didn't want to speak with them, it was always, and they would always make me feel so guilty about it.
Which is exactly what I said to you previously about Dawn when she was in Lucy Pearl. Same thing.
Same thing. It's just like, it started becoming ridiculous though. And so I just, you know, that's what I mean about the jealousy and just the not having great mentors around us that could have reshaped and reformed, you know, the ideals and the outcome of communication and healthy, strong bonds between people that are working together in a band situation. I mean, even that first debut in New York when we all flew out there, even the attitudes of my record label, you know, of Delicious, I'm just saying at that point, they were more my label. I wasn't signed with the band at that point. But to have hired musicians that I did not know, I had only met them a few days prior at rehearsals, and to fly us all out there and put me in a hotel room with three or four other men I don't know, I never really met, I never even had a conversation with. I mean, who does that?
Yeah, that's harsh.
It was harsh. It was so many different, at first it was so many different, thankfully I only had to stay there that one night, but I could have been raped. I could have been, if they weren't decent guys, it could have been anything. I'm telling you, they were rolling out the red carpet for the boys and basically leaving me the bones to do, but I'm carrying all this weight. I have all this responsibility. I'm charging on as the front woman of this band. So, you know, there was a video that was shot for the Heavy Rhyme Experience. And even the attitudes of the guys, I think they started really believing maybe they hadn't had that level of success at that point. And when I came to the video shoot just to like be supportive and check out the video, not to be in it or anything. And they were acting like they didn't even know me. They were, you know, kind of blanking me. And I was like, wow. So I just ended up not staying very long. So it was like so many situations like that. I'm like, wow, I felt almost like
petulant behavior.
Yeah, you know, I felt almost like, wow, I have these evil stepsisters that are treating me, you know, it's sort of like a feeling like that. I'm like, I'm the golden child, but I have these stepsisters that are treating me like some estranged person, or, you know, I'm just glad that I had such a strong foundation and a level of self-esteem.
Yeah. Yeah.
That could really break a person.
Absolutely. I was going to say that if you weren't built like that, that could. Well, and it has done to so many women.
It has. Yeah. It really, really has. You know, you have to have a very strong sense of self if you're even going to even consider coming in a business like that, because certain things like that, maybe they don't happen as much as they did in those days, but you will find eventually you will have some circumstances where, you know, where people, they're not valuing what you have to offer or you as just a human being. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had to learn very, very quickly, you know, to get a thicker skin and to protect my, I guess, to protect my spirit, you know, because there was no one really there to talk about it. And when I did start to talk about it, so many people would just turn a blind eye. They're just like, oh, well, just go on and do the music, just continue on to, you know, and it's like, well, it still doesn't change anything from what I'm emotionally what I'm experiencing on a daily basis in this working environment.
When you were top of your game up here with the Heavies, with Midnight at the Oasis and Dream on Dreamer, brilliant singles, how were you feeling in the band at that point?
When days were good, they were good. Mm. But when they were bad, they were really bad. I did know that there are so many people depending on me. So that strong sense of commitment, it wasn't like I didn't want to go to work. I enjoyed working. I wanted to be there, but I just did not want the treatment that I was receiving.
Yeah, you didn't want to be subjected to the bullying. Yeah.
Yeah, the bullying was just, but it was just growing and getting out of control. And then, and of course, you know, if their friends are starting to join in, it's just, where do I go? I was just becoming more and more miserable by the day. I was just lonely and miserable. And I'm like, London can't be like this. And I didn't blame it on London or attitudes of people in London, because I knew there were certain people that were so kind.
And we had no idea. We had no idea.
I know that, but I couldn't tell you either.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing, because there was so much admiration. I didn't want to let the fans down.
Yeah, of course.
It was a huge, huge thing about the fans. I left in 95.
To be replaced with Carlene Anderson.
Okay, did she come first? There were so many that came after.
I know, that's a huge turnover of lead vocalists. That says a lot, doesn't it?
That says, I'm wondering, did the fans start getting a clue?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious when you've got like 100 lead vocalists, there's something not right there.
There's something, really. And I love Carlene, by the way.
I was going to say, how is your relationship with Carlene? Because she also was from the States. So again, yeah, same dynamic.
Absolutely. I adore Carlene. And she, at the time, was one of my favorite vocalists. There was never any animosity between myself and Carlene.
When did you tell them, that's it for me, I'm leaving?
It was just a collective toxic environment that one day I just said, I can't do this anymore. They were absolutely shocked.
Join me, Joanna Chaundy, next week for part two of the exclusive interview with Andea Davenport, where she talks more about when she left the Brand New Heavies and a certain rap group that happened to be there when she walked out.
I don't even know if they really realized what and how thankful I was at that moment that they were there. They basically took me with them. We walked out together, and no one was going to say anything. I'm standing there with the Beastie Boys. Those New York Brooklyn boys, I don't think so.
Only here on the Baggy Jeans podcast.